Corporal, get me the video cassette of Spaceballs the movie.
Yes, sir.
Producers, 12 chairs, blazing cells, young Frankenstein.
Colonel Sanders, may I speak with you, please?
Yes, sir.
How can there be a cassette of Spaceballs the movie? We're still in the middle of making it.
Oh, that's true, sir. But there's been a new breakthrough in home video marketing.
There has?
Yes. Instant cassettes. They're out in stores before the movie is finished.
Nah.
Here it is, sir. Spaceballs.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klenk.
And I am Troy Harkin. And hey, David, yep. I'm excited that this, A, is our 70th episode.
Yep.
And it's also our final, episode of this season. So that's two reasons to be excited. And what else is this episode, David?
Well, this episode, strange enough, when we plotted out the whole season and figured out our break and figure out which Saturdays we would be running, by fluke, the very last episode of the season would be published on May the 4th. And I think we all know what May the 4th is.
The day after May the 3rd.
Exactly. And it's also the day before May 5th.
That's right. So happy May 4th, everybody.
Yeah, may the 4th be with you. Oh, I've spoiled that.
All right,
that.
Yeah.
Oh.
But, you know, having said that, we have not done a proper Star Wars show. Despite the fact that we've done 70 shows that claim to be a sci-fi show, we have not done a proper Star Wars show. So we thought, you know what, with it being May the 4th, why start now? Let's do a Spaceballs show instead. But I just wanted to say, too, that, you know, There clearly was a time, like, we obviously don't have Spaceballs without Star Wars, but Star Wars, when it did come out in 77, how it impacted so much. If this is a mini Beatleism, I will say it was akin to Beatlemania, where, like, you have this thing that happens in culture and then it affects it for the rest of time, basically.
Yeah.
Today, for example, as I was like scrolling through various videos related to Spaceballs, I found Donnie and Marie's Star Wars special. And I'm going to leave a link for that at some point on our Facebook page so people can check this out. It was like 15 minutes of a Star Wars parody that was on their show with Kris Kristofferson as Han Solo. Had Red Fox as Obi-Wan Kenobi, except they called him something like Okie Fenokie or something like that. And it's something to see. It's just amazing that, it affected everything. There were ripples forever once Star Wars was released. But you know what? Enough of this Lucas worship. We should like slowly get into Spaceballs because that's where we need to be talking and giving love to, right?
Absolutely. Also, I remember seeing that 70s show episode where they're just wondering what all the hoopla is. And you see Kurtwood Smith, I think, was the actor and his son just in the audience. The whole view is just of them in the audience watching the beginning of Star Wars. And then you obviously know that this huge ship is following this small one. And the reaction that they have is just brilliant. And we also did touch on Star Wars at one point about one of our holiday shows. We talked about the holiday episode.
That's right.
Which was quite nuts. But anyways, we do have a special guest for this episode. Dan Miwa is making Woo-hoo! His first appearance on our show. But Troy, would you like to give us a spoiler alert for this 37-year-old film?
Yeah, I'll definitely give a spoiler alert for all the assholes out there.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Who made that man a gunner?
I did, sir. He's my cousin.
Who is he?
He's an asshole, sir.
I know that. What's his name?
That is his name, sir. Asshole. Major asshole.
And his cousin?
He's an asshole too, sir. Gunner's mate, first class, Philip Asshole.
How many assholes we got on this ship anyhow?
Yo!
I knew it. I'm surrounded by assholes.
Thanks, Troy. And we're recording this session via Zoom in the interest of transparency. Troy has known Dan for, I think, exactly 2 decades.
Hold on. You mean two decades now? Starting now?
Or maybe then.
Yeah, or just then. As in just then.
Just now.
Yeah.
Just now. Actually, now it's more than 2 decades. But anyway, it feels more like 2 decades. But anyway, this is my first meeting with Dan. And welcome, Dan.
Hello, everyone.
Hey.
So very nice to be here. Yeah. And I'm so glad to be talking about Spaceballs. It's a fantastic, fantastic movie. And we'll get into it too as well. But one quick thing is that I actually watched Spaceballs before I watched Star Wars. So it was really something that... I don't know. It was a little bit odd because going back to watch the original Star Wars after watching Spaceballs, I was expecting a comedy, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Dan Miwa, lover of all things science fiction and psychological fiction, merged his two favorite genres into his novel Rhett. The story takes place on a distant planet within an alien civilization and follows the life of a little alien through a journey of self-transformation. Much of the charm in Rhett is how a story with a wild, imaginative alien setting can be so relatable at its core. Rhett is not only a powerful coming-of-age story, it's a depiction of human life that holds a mirror to the social challenges we face as a society today. Rhett reached number one in hot new releases and number two bestseller in all sci-fi categories on Amazon. The push for his novel doesn't stop with the written word. Dan is currently working on converting Rhett to a graphic novel and screenplay. As well, he is in the beginning stages of writing a prequel to Rhett, Rhett 2 Zombie Invasion. Just kidding. So, Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi is a look back to when we fell in love with the speculative genre, to recall these times with fondness and affection. I like to start episodes with a quote, so I found this from June 24th of 1987, a review by Roger Ebert on Spaceballs, which he gave 2.5 stars. The movie's dialogue is constructed out of funny names, puns, and old jokes. Sometimes it's painfully juvenile, but there are some great visual gags in the movie, and the best is Pizza the Hut, a creature who roars and cajoles while cheese melts off its forehead and big hunks of pepperoni slide down its jowls. I don't know. How do you review a movie like this anyway? I guess by saying whether you laughed or not. I did laugh, but not enough to recommend the film. I keep waiting for Mel Brooks to do something really great instead of these machine-made satires where 3/4 of the invention goes into the special effects technology. We like to ask our first-time guests their earliest genre memories, loves, and their all-time faves. Dan, what was your first speculative genre memory?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess we're going back so far into my childhood. You know, Spaceballs is actually up there. it would be one of them, but there are a few that I've added to this list. I was thinking about this one. One of the very first movies I ever watched that's related to speculative genre would be Willow, the Ron Howard film, the Ron Howard fantasy. And funny enough, because this is May the 4th, and I guess an homage to George Lucas, this was written by George Lucas as well. Willow was just such a movie that really was played over and over in my house. I think my parents bought the VHS right when it came out. And I remember my brother was really the one who was really big into fantasy, sci-fi. So was I. But I remember there was only one television in the house. And if my dad wasn't watching it, my brother would kind of take over. So he put in Willow and we watched this movie 100 times. What I love about it is this was really before I read JRR. It was before I knew anything about Lord of the Rings. And it was my first taste into fantasy. And one, it's a really great adventure film. There's notes of comedy that are kind of speckled into as well, but I just love the imagery. I love the storyline. I loved where the movie took you into places that, as a kid, I remember maybe I was like 4 or 5 years old, and I never really understood, you know, worlds of magic and, you know, dark evil queens, and, you know, where Willow took you on his adventures, and, you know, with Mad Mardigan. But yeah, that was one that I'll never forget. It's funny. I watched Willow again, I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago, and it still has its charm. I think that, you know, it hasn't lost it, like, really anything. I think that Ron Howard is a really good director, and he, a lot of his films kind of stand up today.
Yeah, yep. One thing that's sort of a similar one, but may have already answered, what was the first speculative genre thing that you actually fell in love with and why? Sometimes that's different than your first memory.
Yeah, you know, so I was thinking about this one as well. And again, I come from a family of, like, artists, right? And my brother was very much an artist. He was a big reader. So was I. But I tended to really pick up the books that were laying around the house that my brother used to read. He was an older brother, 3 years older. So, he was reading a lot more advanced novels. But the ones that I really got, a good taste of was the entire Roald Dahl series, right? So these were the ones, the Roald Dahl series, I think, were a staple in my household. And I've read pretty much every single one of Roald Dahl's books. Obviously favorites being Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach, Witches, and Witches came out with a movie back in the, I think it was the late 80s. But again, it wasn't really as good as the book.
Thanks, Dan, for sharing your sort of genre loves and your first genre memories. But what we'd like to do is just get into our all-time genre faves. Here's some rapid fire questions about your favorite genre things. We're just looking for titles, but if you feel the urge, you can expand a bit, but we do wish to get to talking about Spaceballs soon. So Troy will ask these questions. Take it away, Troy.
Okay, Dan, we may have covered some of this, but who is your favorite all-time genre author?
Yeah, this one was a really tough one to, we know we can talk about, some of the classic authors, Kim Stanley Robinson. My brain also went to some of the modern day fantasy authors, Brandon Sanderson. What I love about him, not only in his works, I love what he writes, but also his impact into the community today, you know, of up and coming authors. I think that we're going to really be thanking Brandon Sanderson in the next 20 or 30 years because of his influence that he has just on younger writers today. Right. But if I were to think of one, and, you know, you guys in the audience may seem this answer to be a little bit weird, but R.L. Stine is probably my favorite all-time author, only because he was the one that got me to read. He was impactful, and he influenced a whole generation of children back in the 90s to actually pick up a book and start reading.
Hmm. Well, do you know?
Oh,
I was going to say, Dan, do you know who wrote the novelization of Spaceballs, perhaps? Any idea?
No.
It would be a Mr. R.L. Stine.
Get out of here. Really?
That's true. Yep. So it's all coming together.
That is crazy.
It's all coming out. Do you mind if we ask you your favorite genre novel?
So I was thinking about this one too. The one that it's pretty recent. The one that I really fell in love with. I mean, I fell in love with a lot of sci-fi novels, but The Martian by Andy Weir.
How about your favorite genre shorter work?
So this is where I had a lot more trouble. I didn't really know what to put down from, you know, from the space of a novella or, you know, a short story. So I actually picked a film. I hope you don't mind. It was The Animatrix. And if anyone here hasn't seen it, go and check it out because it's fabulous.
Sounds good. And we may have touched on this one already, but what is your favorite genre film?
Well, touching on, are we talking about Spaceballs here, Troy? Or
well, if whatever, hey, the heart wants what the heart wants. So whatever, what's your favorite is your favorite.
Yeah, this one, I've got a couple. Spaceballs made it to the list. The Matrix. obviously that one was so impactful into my life. Just because the concept alone, we've seen the story of Terminator of, you know, humans versus machines, and it's a pretty classic tale, but The Matrix took it just to a whole new level. So that's what I loved about that film. And another one is Event Horizon, which is another really good one and scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to your favorite genre TV show.
So again, this was another Star Trek TNG. Had to make it onto this one because my dad, when I was younger, if my brother wasn't watching TV, then my dad was one who stole like the television, and I was forced to watch Star Trek TNG. Luckily, I actually liked it, and I became a Trekkie from when I was 7 years old. So that made the list. And then another one too, which I have to put on this list, is Lost from 2004. I'd say the first four seasons. I wasn't a fan of the ending of Lost, that's for sure. But those first four or five seasons were tremendous writing, really cool concept, and yeah, something that I'll always think of as my favorite TV series.
That's great. Now, this answer, we're looking for an episode, a single episode of television. Does not have to be from one of those shows, but if it is, it is. So what's your favorite episode of television?
So we're talking Lost. I guess I'll start there. What really got me hooked on Lost, it was season one, episode three or four. This is Character Lock. And the whole premise of Lost is that there's an airplane crash into this island, and there's mysterious things happening on this island. You know, it was a pretty big show back in the 2000s. But there's this one character named Locke, and he was on a wheelchair and he couldn't walk. And throughout the whole episode, you didn't know this until like the very end. Right, it would flash back in time, and he was angry because he couldn't go on a walk a mile, or no, sorry, like a walkabout in Australia because, you know, he didn't tell them that he was in a wheelchair and couldn't walk. You only find out at the very end that that was the issue, and then after they land on this or crash on this island, Locke regains his feeling in his legs and he gets to start to walk again. And then it was like it was a big moment when I first saw it. It's like one of those moments where you're like, you know, jaws open, looking at the television.
Right.
Oh my God. And then when you realize like, this is a TV show, we got something here.
Okay. Dan, we are moving on.
Yeah. So on to Spaceballs, Troy Harkin will provide some history, give some background, set it in context before we get into a full discussion on it. Take it away, Troy.
History of the Spaceballs World, Part 2. Mel Brooks is a little old Jewish man who was born in Brooklyn in 1926. Returning to the U.S. after the Second World War, Brooks worked in clubs in the Catskills, first as a musician and later as a comedian. Brooks teamed up with fellow funny man Carl Reiner, and together the two rose to fame. In 1965, Brooks, along with Buck Henry, created the hit James Bond parody TV show Get Smart. Brooks followed that up with the controversial and hilarious film The Producers, about the production of a play entitled Springtime for Hitler. Brooks continued to create seminal genre parodies throughout the 1970s, such as Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. So it should come as no surprise that once Star Wars had become the premier film franchise of the late 70s and early 80s, that eventually Brooks would create his take on the series. Mel Brooks wrote the screenplay for Spaceballs with Ronnie Graham and Thomas Meehan. When the script was finished, he sought out approval from Star Wars creator George Lucas. Lucas said, "I've seen Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles. I trust your judgment." Now, the only caveat from Lucas was that Brooks would not be allowed to create merchandising for Spaceballs, which is an interesting fact we'll get back to later. Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks were approached to play the part of Lone Star. Both declined. Brooks also wanted Steve Martin to play Colonel Sanders. In the end, SCTV alum John Candy and Rick Moranis were cast as Barf the Mog and Dark Helmet, respectively. Newcomer Bill Pullman took the role of Lone Star, and on the suggestion of Robin Carl Reiner, Brooks cast Daphne Zuniga as his Druish princess, Princess Vespa. And stay tuned for the end of the episode when we get into our own dream casting and Schrodinger's cast on how we would like to see it have turned out. Spaceballs was released on June 27th, 1987. It was made for $22.7 million with an effects budget of $4 million. And the film took in $38.1 million at the box office. The film also did impressive business in the still burgeoning home video market. Critic Gene Siskel gave Spaceballs 3 out of 4 stars. In 2008, Spaceballs, the animated series, was released. There have been discussions of a sequel to the original film with titles such as Spaceballs 3, The Search for Spaceballs 2, and Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money. But with John Candy dead and Mel Brooks pushing 100, this may be unlikely. And David, that is our all-too-brief history of Spaceballs.
Thanks a lot, Troy. And I was wondering, Dan, what was your first experience? Like, when did you first see Spaceballs?
Wow. I think I was 6 or 7. Right. So the film came out when I was 3, and I think I watched it first when I was, maybe like 6 or 7 years old. What used to happen in my house is that so my parents, they would go to Video 99, because I don't think Blockbuster was around even back then. They would rent VHSs, and then Friday nights, the kids would go to bed early, and my parents would watch whatever they rented. But the next morning, the kids would get up. So me and my brother would get up. My parents would be sleeping in, and we would always watch the movies that were left over. So we would always watch the movies that were rented, you know, the night before. And this was one of them. This was actually one of them. There was a few other movies that I probably shouldn't have been watching as a 7-year-old. Some of them were rated R, but this one actually wasn't. I think this one was like a PG or PG-13 movie. But I remember my brother just popped it in. We had gotten up. We got ourselves a bowl of cereal and just, you know, sat in front of the TV and started watching it. And it was. I didn't think much of it. I thought it was funny. Obviously, at that age, there were some jokes I just didn't get. It still held my attention. And then, my parents bought the VHS later on, and it was just something that was always in my house.
And immediately you loved it?
I don't know. You know, I think I don't know if I immediately loved it, because, you know, a lot of the humor I just didn't really understand. But the first time, when I was so young. But, you know, and I'm sure this has happened with a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. Not always, you know, like the first take of something doesn't always catch your attention, or you don't fall in love with it, right? But, you know, as you start to grow with it, because it was always being played in my house for some reason. As you start to understand more and more, as you get older, you start to appreciate more like about it, right? So I think that's kind of what happened. I don't think I fell in love with it right at first, but it's something I grew to love.
You know, it seems like there's a lot of similarities to the Batman 1966 series, where if you watched that as a kid, you know, it was very dramatic and you took it at face value. And it felt like life or death situations. But then as you grew up, you got the humor and you understood that, you know, it was intentionally campy and whatnot, which was totally over your head when you're younger. It's just like, this is Batman. He's fighting crime. Oh my God. He could die in this scenario, you know? So I get how it could have its appeal. And then as you grow, it has a whole other level to it.
Go ahead. I don't want to.
No, ahead. It does for sure. The general storyline, I think we understood. So me and my brother, we understood. I think he understood more because he was a little bit older. You know, but there was jokes like, and I forget the lady's name who told Shrew to beam her up or to beam you up. I forget her name. She's like the general, right?
But, oh, yeah. Like Commanderette Zardon or something like that. I've got it here somewhere.
Zircon.
Zircon.
You know, like the joke where she said, oh, Snotty beat me twice last night, and it was wonderful.
right.
I know. Like, as a 7-year-old, you wouldn't know what that meant, right? But as you get older, it's like, oh, okay, now I understand.
David, when did you first see it?
I probably don't have as good a story, and I want to hear what you have to say, Troy. But for me, I would watch, like, on TV or whatever it was or something, I would just, there would be a bit of it, I would just catch it somewhere in the middle or whatever, and I'd watch a minute or two and just be completely unimpressed or not care or not think it was funny, because I had a very high standard with Blazing Saddles and with Young Frankenstein and those kinds of films, that it just didn't do anything for me. And I just actually couldn't stand it. So, but I never gave it a chance. When you actually sit your ass in a chair, watch it from the beginning, it's a whole different film. Like for me, and we'll get into this later about what our favorite comedies are of all time. But certainly this one holds up a bit because of the cumulative nature and what it's trying to do as it builds an effect and takes you through the story. And just seeing bits here and there with something like Airplane, you can actually watch bits here and there and laugh your ass off. This, you have to watch the whole thing. And it gets better every viewing. Every time you see it, it gets better and funnier.
Yeah, we're talking about that, comparing notes on that. And we both found that true, Dan, where, like, David and I have watched it a lot in the last little while, and I found like I've almost become addicted to it. You know, it's like the jokes get funnier because it feels like there's like a nudge nudge wink wink with every joke, like, isn't that fucking stupid, but we're, you know, and but that becomes the joke, like it's like a joke about itself almost. It's so funny that way.
So I would agree with you. You can, what I like about Mel is that, yes, it's slapsticky, it's quick, it's humorous, but there is structure to it. And one of the things that I've, when, you know, I was thinking about it, which I never really thought about in this much detail, but the maid, I wonder, they had that last scene where the maid's head falls on the planet, and it's Planet of the Apes. And they come on the helmet and everyone comes walking out, and the Planet of the Apes guy says, oh shit, there goes the planet. They had to make sure that that head looked like the Statue of Liberty, right? So they would have had to have made sure that the spaceship turns into a maid. Right. So it's like, if one joke is kind of tailing off another joke, you know, it has a domino effect. Right. So they had to set this up early on in the storyline just for that one scene to happen. Cause you couldn't use that scene with, if it was like just a bronze head of just a random, you know what I mean?
Like they would have had to,
yes.
And also what I just noticed today, because I think we talked about this a little bit, but what I just noticed on a quick viewing, before the show was that, when the Transformer, what's it called, Megamade is first, sorry, we're gonna have my first laughing fit. When Megamade is sucking off Druidia, her headpiece does not have the crown, like the tiara. But when everybody is evacuating the ship, the prongs of the tiara appear and they shoot out of there. And now it's ready to go for the Planet of the Apes joke. So it's like, like it's a perfect setup. Like, it's like, wow, you like actually, like there's a lot of thought put into this, you know, it's kind of like, it's not as dumb as it seems. You know? So I'll just quickly say, I sort of had a similar thing with David. I had a really brief period of time, Dan, in the, I guess, mid to late 80s, where I was a bit of an art snob because I was seeing somebody who was an art snob. And so, you know, I was only seeing films that were subtitled for most of that period. You know, I was not seeing anything like blockbustery. I was definitely not seeing anything that was broad comedy, even though most of my life I enjoyed that, and most of the subsequent part of my life I enjoyed that. But this one little window when Spaceballs came out, I saw it was released, and actually her younger brother said, look at this film. It looks hilarious. It looks like the best thing ever. And I went, yeah, well, clearly this is for like a 12-year-old. and I didn't see it. I didn't see it until a bunch of years. Well, not a bunch of years ago, but probably this century. And my wife had seen it when she was younger, you know, and it was like a fun film for her to see with her best friend when it came out in 87. and she enjoyed it. And the funny thing is, like, since we got on the movie to do the show with you, I've rewatched it and rewatched it. And now I'm the one that I'm the idiot who loves watching it over and over again. And she's like, are you going to put that on again? So well, she's maxed out and I'm good to go now.
There is genius put into comedy. You know, I think a really well-written comedy is just as difficult or as genius as like a really good drama or a psychological thriller or, you know, it's, or a really well done horror, you know, it's another expression of art. And it's, you're really trying to, I think that making someone laugh, I mean, maybe I still don't know how I feel about this, but I think that making someone laugh is almost just as difficult or even more tough than making someone cry. Or, I think, you know, it takes just as much effort and energy and thought to make a funny script as opposed to a, you know, dramatic or a sad script.
Yeah, I think you're right, because with some tragedies or whatever, a drama that will make you cry, it becomes conditioned, right? I can talk to that because I'm a weeper. And like even films like stupid films like Field of Dreams, which I love, and E.T., I will cry. There's no way I'm not crying. There's no way I'm not crying at the end of these films. But I know that part of it is that I've been conditioned to cry. I had an original response and now I anticipate that response, you know? But with comedy, it's not always that way, because comedy, like horror, relies on surprise, on the element of surprise. And once you've had that surprise, and you can't ever be the same again, right? So you're right. There is something about evoking a laugh that is, you know, genuine. Can we just have a little quick breakdown? It's for folks who have not seen Spaceballs and don't know what we're talking about. First of all, you should go out to your video store like they do in the film and you should get it. You should, or stream it, I guess, nowadays. See, we're too old farts, so that's the way we rolled in. Anyway, we still think there's Blockbusters out there and Roger's Video too. Anyway, this is the first 7 minutes of the film. Like, I'm just going to break it down really quickly. But just to, my point basically is with this, that Mel Brooks, he takes so many cracks at jokes that they don't all land, but many of them do. And it's just sort of this thing that you're hit with so many jokes that you will end up laughing. Anyway, this is just the first 7 minutes. So after the Roaring Lion, we see a starfield and then the first titles, Once Upon a Time Warp. So there you go. That's your first joke. Your very first thing is you get that gag. And immediately I like this film for proper use of ellipses, because I hate a 4-point ellipses, I must say, which Lucas sometimes uses. It's a 3-point ellipses, dude. Use it. You don't need a full stop after an ellipses. Okay. Anyway, but I like that Mel knows how to use an ellipses. Then we get the scroll, or crawl, if you will. Visually, it's identical to Star Wars. It reads, in a galaxy very, 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 very far away, there lived a ruthless race of beings known as Spaceballs. And then chapter 11, which is funny. The evil leaders of planet Spaceball, having foolishly squandered their precious atmosphere, have devised a secret plan to take every breath of air away from their peace-loving neighbor, planet Druidia. Today is Princess Vespa's wedding day. Unbeknownst to the princess, but known to us, danger lurks in the stars above. So we get another joke. If you can read this, you don't need glasses. another joke. So we're a minute 47 seconds into the film, and we have 7 gags in the scroll. Then we cut to the slow flyby of the gigantic spaceship Spaceball 1. From this single shot, we get 3 gags. How ridiculously long the ship is, the bumper sticker on the tail of the ship, we break for nobody, and the Jaws parody music that gets going, but never really goes anywhere because it keeps restarting at the doo-dun, doo-dun. And then we cut to the interior bridge of Spaceball 1 for the scene with Colonel Sanders in Dark Helmet. So in that scene, which plays out at roughly 3 minutes, we get 11 more gags, including a joke about sci-fi exposition dialogue, you know, with the, you got it, when they look at the camera, and a spit take onto the camera lens. In total, we have 21 gags in the first 7 minutes, and it doesn't let up through the movie after that. So I just wanted to break it down for folks, how many different types of jokes we get. And
That's a really good, so you know what, it's funny because now I'm learning about Spaceballs. I've watched the movie 100 times, but I didn't realize that the music during the long scene with the spaceship, I didn't realize that was Jaws. But and I can see the humor in it because Jaws gets progressively faster. But it makes so much sense because the spaceship never ends. Like I think the whole shot is like a minute and 40 seconds, like whatever it is. And you're sitting there watching it and the music score makes perfect sense because it's not like it's a crescendo of events that are happening. It's just one long take. So to hear that, makes perfect sense. And it's a gag. And it's a really good gag.
Yeah.
It's smart.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a great score, actually. Yeah. Now, before we get into like kind of a free for all type of thing where we all do whatever we need to do here, I just thought it might be good for the audience to hear from the three of us what informs our sense of humor. Like, what's our favorite comedy film? I guess of all time, but you know, that's open to our own personal interpretation from day to day. What about you guys? What's your like one of your favorite comedy films other than Spaceballs?
So I'll go. Being a kid who grew up in the late 90s and the 2000s, I'd have to say Dumb and Dumber is up there as maybe being number one or number two. Right. And it was a Farrelly Brothers movie. It was just Jim Carrey at his prime. And what I love about comedy too, this is what I noticed about comedy. So if you look at the Dumb and Dumber script, so this is the whole story. So these two guys, they lose their jobs. They find a briefcase. They know the owner. The briefcase has a bunch of money in it that they don't know. Then as a way to return the briefcase back to the owner, they travel across America. They go to the mountains where they get threatened to be killed and murdered because they stole like $1 million. That's the premise of the whole story. But when you watch the movie, I never picked up in it at all. All I really understood and really focused on was just the comedy, the Jim Carrey just being an absolute nut. And just all the antics that went into like their whole journey. I never really picked up on the actual storyline. Really. And what I love about comedy is that you can have a storyline that really is like, doesn't make a lot of sense, but if it's involved in a comedy, it doesn't matter. Right. Because the essence of the movie is the comedy itself.
Yeah. We sort of touched on that when we were talking the other night, how, you know, basically the plot is just the, almost like the set dressing. It's like the thing you hang it on and for a comedy. And then the rest of it is just the set pieces, the gags, you know, it's like, oh, we're doing this type of film. Well, we could do this gag and do this gag and do this gag.
Totally.
Yeah. And certainly with that film, I think I read or heard somewhere, maybe with something on TV about the ending that originally, I think they had the concept that the main character would end up with the woman, like they would somehow, and then they talked about this, that, you know what, they're so dumb that there's no way that's gonna happen, and then they just made sure it ended the way it ended. But they did consider that Hollywood or that good ending where, you know, things go well for him, but they were just being honest about it. So for me, Airplane is number one. I also have things like The Naked Gun, Tropic Thunder, The Court Jester, and there's just so many because I'm a huge fan of comedies. But with something like the Airplane film, the running gags, you know, I picked the wrong week to quit, you know, sniffing glue, amphetamines, and so on. You got, have you ever been in a Turkish prison, Billy? Do you like to see grown men naked? You know, that whole running thing. Like they have all of these sets of running jokes throughout the whole film. And if you just look at the number of sight gags or jokes and just add it up, how many are actually good, which are basically every one throughout the entire film, it's probably got the most laughs per minute of any film I've ever seen.
Yeah. And I have a feeling like there must be a way to verify this or not, but so a few years ago, I found out how there is some actual film, and not Airplane, but there's an actual film that predates, not Airport, because there's that whole series of Airport films, which at surface level, it definitely looks like it's parodying those films. But there's one film in particular from, I think, the late 60s that it is Airplane. And you're familiar with the idea of riffing, Dan, like on Mystery Science 3000, where they sit in front of an old crappy film and they basically make fun of it while the film's going on.
So
my impression is that the guys who made Airplane were riffing on this old film. Like, they must have seen it like smoking up in their dorm one night or something and just started like riffing. And I know that's something we used to do. But it's funny how, like, I've seen it since, and it's like scene for scene Airplane. It's just doesn't have the funny stuff happening, you know. So it's God bless the fact that they did that, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that, you know, whatever. Like, because as we said, the premise of a comedy is just there for to hang the jokes on. So hey, and Airplane, when I saw it, which was played at our high school, that was the first experience of not being able to hear a film, because people were laughing so loudly over the gags that you definitely had to see it a second time to take it all in. And it's definitely got to be one of the highest, like, laughs per gag of any film. Like, there's so many, and so many of them hit the mark. So I know what you're talking about, David.
Go ahead, Dan.
Sorry, I was just gonna say, so that really skyrocketed Leslie Nielsen's career, because Dave, you were talking about, like, the Naked Gun. The Naked Gun is, again, another series, like, all the three trilogies, Naked Gun 1, 2.5, and then 3 and a third, which is a gag in its own. Those were fantastic movies. Like, I was gut-busting the whole movie through Naked Gun 1, which I've seen 100 times. Gut-busting, right? Like, just, I love, like, the one scene, too, where, I know we're off topic, we're not talking about Spaceballs, but, like, the one scene where he goes to that, whereas he goes to, like, some manufacturing place, and then the guy's up above, and he's like, "I got something to say to you from Mr. Ludwig." And then as he's saying it, he's shooting his gun. And then Frank goes, "You got to stop shooting your gun. I can't hear you." Meanwhile, he's shooting at him. He doesn't clue in, doesn't realize.
Well, Pat, David, who we recently saw The Shining, David, Pat and I, we always refer to as our listener. he and I discovered Police Squad when it came on TV. And, like, we were, I think at the time, two of the few people who, like, really loved it. And when it was on TV, it got lost because people didn't know how to handle no laugh track. And having something so straight-faced delivered without a laugh track, that they just didn't know what to make of it. And it wasn't until the films came out that it was like, yeah, it's funny, because I can hear people laughing. I get it.
And it was only 6 episodes, like the original.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know how you do 6 episodes, and then they decide whether or not they're going to continue it for 13, like the people and the management or whatever say, well, we'll extend it to 13, and then they'd extend it for a season, then come back for it. Like, there's all these levels. And it was one just like Quark, the one about the garbage delivery guy, was 6 episodes. So with that, I don't know how it was only 6 episodes, but some of the gags, like the Club Flamingo, were walking through the Japanese garden, or when they're shooting at each other and then you pan back and they're 10 feet from each other behind car, like all of that stuff, or when he always backs into a garbage can. Like, there's so many running gags and brilliance in the original series that was brought into the movie.
Yeah, and the freeze frames at the end, you know, when they would have the closing credits of the TV show, and they would
and
be
one
like
person's
a fake,
walking.
Yeah. It would look like a freeze frame, but people would just hold themselves still, you know.
Yeah, but one person would be walking around thinking, "Why are all these people stopped?"
Yeah, like a dog would walk in too. Like,
yeah.
Walk through. Yeah.
Oh, anyway, my God,
it was great. It was great. Anyway, I'll just give you a quickie. I mean, I loved Airplane too. I loved like the Woody Allen stuff. I loved the early lowbrow stuff, and I loved his early highbrow stuff. And I know Crucify Me because I said Woody Allen, but and also Duck Soup. Like, I love the Marx Brothers. They slay me in a way that nothing did until Airplane, that type of stuff, or Blazing Saddles, because really we don't get Airplane without Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, which is doing a parody of genre stuff. Like it's taking a specific thing and then going to town on it. Usually you get, comedies prior to that were basically like, we do have some sort of like a story that we're trying to tell, and we'll try to make it funny. But when you don't have to do that, when you just take the situation and you can go to town, then you get something like Spaceballs. So Spaceballs, let's do it.
Yeah. So quickly, if I can, because I'm not sure if I'm able to get this in, is that I watched it for maybe the sixth or seventh time last night. I made some very quick notes, which will take me about a minute and a half to go through. And I thought I would just quickly, because these are just quick highlights, and I just wrote down quick notes. So basically what I've got is, and I'll just do this as fast as I can, scrolling text. If you can read this, you don't need glasses. Long spaceship, we break for nobody. Colonel Sanders, arrival of Dark Helm. But I can't breathe in this thing. Instead of the throat, it is the balls with ring. We call it Mr. Coffee. Must get through the air shield. Did everyone get that? Tomorrow, bingo. My droid of honor, Dot Matrix. I don't love him. The last prince left in the galaxy. First appearance of Winnebago, Eagle. I heart Uranus. Raise your hand, song playing. Vinny, Pizza the Hut. The air shield effect is very cool, by the way. Earmuffs, sound music she likes to listen to. Perry Air, Rhett Zircon, Snotty, Beam Me Down, works on Star Trek. This time I'm going to walk, and it's funny, that gag. He walks into it's right into the next room. Why is he beaming? But it's right in the next room. I don't have to put up with this. I'm rich. How many assholes we got on this ship? I am surrounded by assholes. Keep firing assholes, which is the funniest bit. I just love that. We've got a thing about death. It's not us. Just passing Jupiter 2, got them in a magnetic beam. Jam the radar. Michael Winslow. I love Michael Winslow, by the way. The effects are incredible. Only one man who would dare give me the raspberry, Lone Star, half man, half dog. Her matched luggage. What does she think this is? A princess cruise? I will not be rescued in such filth. That's all we need, a Jewish princess. Funny, she doesn't look Jewish. Lone Star, ludicrous speed. What's the matter, Colonel Sanders? Chicken? They've gone to plaid. Let's take a 5-minute break. Take only what you need to survive. And then I thought it was almost like a Lawrence of Arabia parody. Welcome to real life. Welcome to real life. If you want this hair dryer, you can carry it. Get me the video cassette of Spaceballs, a movie. I think we'll talk about that a bit. A breakthrough in the home video market. Prepare to fast forward. You are looking at now. Parody of Who's on First. He doesn't do it for you with hand gestures. My Virgin alarm, it is programmed to go off before you do. Nice dissolve. Jaws sound is of the ship showing up. Then the small creatures and the bridge on the River Kwai song. Prepare to go out. Why are you always preparing? Just go. The Wizard of Oz parody. Looks like the Temple of Doom. Sure isn't Temple Beth Israel. Yogurt. Who hasn't heard of yogurt? I'm just plain yogurt. The Schwartz. And then so on. So I think I've got a bit more, but I think that's enough. And I go on for another couple pages, which I will not share with you, but it's just jam packed.
That was a great synopsis. Yes. Not even a synopsis. That was a great list of just gags.
Yeah. It should be a poem, David. That almost felt like a poem there.
Yeah. Like, and went for another page and a half, but I felt maybe I shouldn't have done it, but there was just so much. It really is accumulative, and it just has so much to it that it is worth seeing for sure.
Well, even as I was like breaking down some of it, I thought, okay, there's going to be there's going to be three or four scenes to talk about. and then I started making this list, and we can, we can sort of like touch on these, but here's my quick list. It's very concise. So what are your favorite scenes? I have Alien Space Bar, which again means the diner, with the whole alien parody scene. The Now and Then video scene.
Mm. What the hell am I looking at? When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
What happened to then?
We passed then.
When?
Just now. We're at now now.
Go back to then.
When?
Now.
Now?
Now.
I can't.
Why?
We missed it.
When?
Just now.
When will then be now? Soon.
Which to me is, the more I watch it, like it's just genius. Like I really do think it's like, it's one of my all time favorite comedy scenes on film. The asshole scene, which, you know, it's just done so well, but I mean, this is the guy who was partly responsible for the 2,000-year-old man, right? So clearly it's going to have some great dialogue. And even just that one stupid line that makes me look, I'm laughing and I'm actually smiling. What's the matter, Colonel Sanders? Chicken? You know, like, that was another one, Dan, where it's like, we're just calling him Colonel Sanders for this one gag. You know, like they could have like milked that easily, right? But they didn't. In fact, I was even wondering if when Barf was eating from the bucket, it was like, was that Kentucky Fried Chicken or something? But no, it's something grosser. The whole light speed, ludicrous speed plaid, the comb the desert bit, this is a little bit longer. It involves some other, like some like sub elements, like the rescue scene, which has the stunt double gag, which is so funny. Vespa, Vespa like has a Hitler mustache, her stunt double, which is very like, how Mel Brooks is that? And then her getting pissed off and yelling, you know, they shot my hair. And then her going, kind of apeshit and shooting all the stormtroopers. And, Barf says, not bad for a girl. Not bad for a girl. And, Dot Matrix says, not bad for Rambo. Which is, you know, great. And then, of course, Dark Helmet playing with his action figures. So we're taking all the stuff here. But, of course, the merchandising. Like, how great is that?
That one is a great scene. And, yeah, so you guys have pretty much spoken to all of the scenes that I had on my list as well.
So what are your favorites? Do you have any in particular? Or is it too tough to call? And you too, David.
It's tough to call for me, but like the top ones is assholes. Keep firing, assholes. I mean, how do you not just laugh your behind off on that? The other one too, that so like the Calm the Desert, that's another favorite scene of like mine. And not because of the gag of them actually like physically combing the desert with big Acme combs, which is really funny, but I love when they get to the third guy. So Helmet's out in the desert, right? And he's screaming out. He's like, you guys find anything yet? Nothing yet, sir. And then he goes, you know, to the other guy, says, what about you guys? And he's got an Afro pick, right? And he's an African American, and he's combing the desert. He pulls his helmet up. He says, we ain't found shit. Just the way that he says it was just so like on the nose and on point.
Yeah.
And the attitude involved, like it was the comedic timing was bang on.
Yeah. And the nice thing is it takes a visual gag of the combing the desert, which could have been enough, right? But then it ups the ante, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I find keeps happening. If you have this one thing, but then he tweaks it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just love the delivery of that line. And then there was also, I don't know if we talked about this one, it was on either one of your lists, but there was the scene where they jammed the radar. Mm-hmm. You know, radar is about to get jammed. And he presses the button, and then raspberry jam hits the big satellite or dish or whatever. And then it's the guy from the Police Academy movies, the guy that makes all those sounds.
Yeah. Michael Winslow. Yeah.
Michael Winslow? Okay. Yeah. Okay. I don't know him from anything else except for the Police Academy movies, but when he sees like his screen is going all shaky, right? And then he goes and picks up his radio and he goes, doot, doot, doot. He goes, hey, sir, with that really weird voice, please, sir. And then Helmet and then Colonel Sanders walk over to him and he's got his mic and he's like, we're having a radar, sir. And then Colonel Sanders, you don't need that. You can put it down. And then And he still says, "Round draw the radar, sir," in the same type of voice. Yeah. And then Helmet like takes all of his like keyboards, he just destroys them all. He's like, "What did you say?" He's like, "We're having trouble with the radar, sir." But it's those small little subtle things. Like it's almost like a build up to the actual joke. The real joke for the Comb the Desert is the combs, right? But what I get out of it, like just the delivery of that one line is just what really got me, you know, how he delivers it and says it. And then the guy, when he says, "We got the jeeps, the creeps and the bleeps." The yeah. What? And he goes through the whole spiel of, you know, doing the sound effects and everything. Yeah.
Oh, and also with the desert, we have Rick Moranis is now wearing the pith helmet, like the dark helmet size pith helmet, which is hilarious. Like it looks like something from a Warner Brothers cartoon. And the little thing where he can open it and close it too, because he's still talking through it, which is just hilarious. I mean, I think that's the great thing too, is that you know what he's saying about Darth Vader is that it's an impractical helmet, you know, because it's like you have to keep opening and closing it in reality to talk. Otherwise, you need somebody to voice over what you're saying, like James Earl Jones.
Well, you couldn't be Helmet. So here's the thing too. So the character could not be Helmet without taking his face shield up.
Yeah,
like the very first scene where Helmet is walking on the bridge and the dark music is playing, and then all of a sudden he just lifts his helmet up or lifts his face mask up and says, "I can't breathe in this thing," you know, and Rick Moranis is so much of a character in this story or in this movie that if he had his helmet down the whole time, even if he was still like delivering funny lines with his helmet down, I don't think it would have the same effect. Like you have to have the helmet up, right?
Okay. Like, let me ask both of you this then. Is this Rick Moranis's best performance in film? Consider, you know, there's Strange Brew. I love him in Streets of Fire. A lot of people don't know that one, but he plays a more serious role. Ghostbusters, Little Shop of Horrors, and Honey, I Shrunk the Sequels. Now, I'm not talking about best film necessarily, but is it his best performance? And I'm not trying to lead you. If you don't think so, you don't think so. But I think it's got to be up there. What's that?
Ghostbusters was a fantastic film, and Rick Moranis killed it because when he was taken over by the ghost, like we got to see, even though it was still comedy, we still got to see a little bit of acting from Rick.
Yeah,
you know, outside of just, you know, his slapsticky type of comedic character. So in an overall performance, I think that he was given more opportunity to really act in Ghostbusters. Spaceballs, he doesn't really ever change character throughout the whole story, like the whole movie, right? So he's very much the same type of character, he knows his role, right? And he did a really good job doing it. Do I think it's his best role? I think that Ghostbusters kind of takes the cake on that one.
But could they have done the film without him? Like, we're going to get into like who could have done a Dark Helmet in a little bit, but I guess for me, it's just he does such a great job of owning the character, and he does have that, you know, he does the mask version of Dark Helmet. Then he does his more sort of slightly nebbish, irritable Jewish man version of him when his mask is up. But I absolutely adore him when he does the bit after Lightspeed where he's like punch drunk or whatever.
"Are you all right, sir?"
"Fine. How have you been?"
"Fine, sir."
"Good.
It's a good thing you were wearing that helmet."
"Yeah.
What should we do now, sir?"
"Well, are we stopped?"
"We're stopped, sir."
"Good. Well, why don't we take a 5-minute break?"
"Very good, sir."
"Smoke if you got 'em."
It's tough. I mean, clearly Ghostbusters is a better film, but it feels like, you know, he gets to be the guy. He gets to be the man in this one. He gets to be the Venkman, basically, in this film.
Yeah, he obviously took much more of a leading role, right? I think that he kind of stole the show away from Bill Pullman. I think that Helmet, you know, he kind of overshadowed Bill Pullman. Bill Pullman was like the protagonist, you know, in this comedy. But, you know, I really appreciated Helmet, you know, and I really Bill Pullman was still funny at times, but his character really wasn't like the central or the center of all the comedy in this film. I find that Helmut really was the one that really stole the show.
And
to your question, I don't think anyone else but like Rick could have done this role.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rick Moranis gives good Helmut.
Yeah. It's good Helmut.
Hey, that's a paraphrase, man. I'm not being that way. I'm paraphrasing the film. This is source material shit.
Yeah. But John Candy also gives good Mog. John Candy is very much underappreciated in this.
So good.
He plays a buddy. It's almost like a buddy film. He's very supportive. He's the one that at different times just goes in there and just really does a supportive thing for Lone Star. And it's just, you can just see that caring and love for each other.
One thing I did want to mention, I'm just trying to find my note on it, was regarding the fourth wall. So I said that Spaceballs breaks the fourth wall so often. It's like a garage with the garage door permanently open. It's just like the whole thing, the whole time it feels like there is no fourth wall, which is great. They do it so often. So like, yeah, as we said, asking the audience if they got it after background exposition, spitting coffee on the camera lens, putting the home video of the film we're watching on the screen, killing the sound guy with a laser sword, because you can't say lightsaber, because Lucas will sue you, eh? Anyway. seeing the stunt doubles, Colonel Sanders hitting the wrong button, and the screen goes black. That part I always forget about, too. It's like, what did you do? Oh, you turned the whole movie off! you know, there's so much of it. Now, Mel Brooks has done this in the past, like in Blazing Saddles, there was the finale fight scene where it breaks right into another movie. And Mojo actually ranked Spaceballs, the video scene, as the greatest breaking the fourth wall scene in film. I mean, what's not to love about it, right?
Well, it's such a difficult task to do, even in a comedy. You know, I think that, it has to be done with like precision, or else I don't think it really delivers well. But I had no problems in all the times that I've watched Spaceballs. I think it really adds to the entire comedy of the movie. How many other comedies do you really know that have actually broken the fourth wall successfully as well as Mel Brooks has done? Blazing Saddles and Spaceballs. The one thing that I know we've touched on and talked about is the now versus then, when he picks up the VHS of Spaceballs. When I first saw that, I was blown away. It was like, this is brilliant, you know. And then not only is the concept brilliant, but then the gag that he has to follow it is just so good too. Like, when will then be now? Soon.
Oh.
Like it's comedic genius.
Dreamcasting. Yeah. Dreamcasting, baby.
So, with Dreamcasting, what we do is we take the best actors, living or dead, for the roles in this film, which is Spaceballs. And we try to recast it as we would imagine it. And then after that, we'll get into Schrodinger's cast. And with Schrodinger's cast, which we originally called Screamcasting, it's sort of a very weird take on things. So we're doing Lone Star, who was played by Bill Pullman in his second screen role, his first major screen role. Barf by John Candy. Princess Vespa was played by Daphne Zuniga. Dot Matrix was voiced by Joan Rivers. Dark Helmut, as we have just been talking about, was Rick Moranis, and Mel Brooks played the dual roles of Scroob and Yogurt. All right, so I was thinking, what if we did not have Bill Pullman? Who would we go for Lone Star, and who might have a quality similar to Bill Pullman? Two folks came to mind for me. One was Ryan Gosling originally, But then I went with someone sort of that was of that generation's, like when Bill Pullman was younger, I thought of Jeff Daniels, who has done some great comedies. Dan Miwa mentioned one of his favorite comedies, Dumber Dumber. But also I love him in Purple Rose of Cairo, a Woody Allen, I guess romantic comedy. So that's who I'm going with. Jeff Daniels for my Lone Star. And, filling in for Barf, that's not easy considering John Candy is just such a legend. But I'm sorry if I'm just going with sort of the idea of size, but I went with Kenan Thompson from SNL, who I just felt like he sort of has that warmth as well. He would have made a good Barf.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I like your choices. I went with, or should I say the word nice. We're not allowed to use
nice.
That word,
that's me. Yeah. Yeah. I've got copyright on that. Sorry, David.
Okay. I picked Peter Weller for Lone Star. Cause I just like the kind of roles that he was in. Oh, I like your nice. Your use of the word nice was very nice there.
It was very sincere, wasn't it?
It
authentic.
Was.
Yeah.
Well, you can't fake that.
Yeah.
That was a real nice. That wasn't a fake nice.
Yeah.
But, and then for Barf, I picked John Goodman.
John Goodman, yes. I think we definitely do a good job there. I like it.
So do I. So John Goodman was actually one of the ones that I had on my list, but I changed it at like the last minute because I think that if you're looking at Lone Star and Barf, they have to have a really good relationship, right? So off screen and on screen, you know. So I went with a bit of the SNL route, where I'm not sure if Lone Star is going to be a good fit, but Barf certainly will. So Lone Star, put Norm MacDonald, because he still has that witty. I think Norm MacDonald is a little bit too dry for the character, but I think he'd still be a good fit. And then Barf, I did Chris Farley.
Farley, yeah. All right, so we're moving on to Princess Vespa and Dot Matrix. This one was a little hard for me because I was going for that sort of beautiful Jewish princess thing. I was also thinking of the era. I was thinking of the 80s originally. So my two that I didn't go with that occurred to me were Neve Campbell and Phoebe Cates, who I was still thinking Phoebe Cates might have been the way to go, but I didn't. I went with Alison Brie, who I find hilarious, attractive. I think she would be wonderful in that role.
Well, guess what, handsome hobo? Your gravy train's leaving the station. Chuck, 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 chuck,
chuck, chuck, chuck, chuck, chuck. But David, I do think that I have to retire Alison Brie from my draft choices from now on, because I'm pretty sure I've done her at least three other times. This may be my retiring of Alison Brie. So Alison Brie, thank you for your service.
Thank you so much.
And Dot Matrix. So that was voiced by Joan Rivers. And this one came to me immediately. This is who I would go with, and I'm just going to give it to you, Sarah Silverman.
Definitely. That's a great choice.
For my Princess Vespa, and I've always wondered about the pronunciation. I should have done some prep work before this episode, whether it's Carla Gugino or...
I think Gugino, I believe it is. But
Gugino.
Awesome in Gerald's Game by Mike Flanagan. Yeah.
Right, and I
that
still
was
have
fantastic
to see that one.
Movie. It's great.
Yeah,
yeah,
Because I've just seen her in so many other things, even Watchmen and a bunch of things, and she's just great.
Oh, right, yeah, she is. Yep.
Trisha Helfer, I picked because I wanted to pick someone that has played a robot or played a thing before, and she was great in, of course, the Battlestar Galactica, the reboot.
Yeah, and hey. Why not have Trisha Helfer as part of your cast? You can't lose there.
So for me, Princess Vespa, I thought about this one a lot, and I think a great fit would be Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Get out!
Right.
From Seinfeld, a young Julia Louis, because she's Jewish, she's got the dark hair.
Yes.
And I think if you just have a little bit of attitude
yes.
into
well,
her as a younger lady... She'd be perfect for it.
You take no shit from Elaine, right? So that's the thing. She would be great.
She'd be excellent. And then Dot, Kristen Wiig, because Kristen Wiig has that kind of spunky attitude again, right?
I think you're right. Has. Yep. And she can do a lot with her voice. Like she would be able to project beyond like the limitations of no screen presence, basically. Okay. Am I up again?
Oh yeah.
All right. We're turning to the dark side here. So, Dark Helmet. First of all, Patton Oswalt came to mind, and I do think he would be great if my next pick was not available. But I'm going back to the SCTV roots, it's funny. Over the years, I've learned to like Martin Short. I didn't like him when he first came on the scene, but I now really love everything he does. And I get even the earlier stuff. I think he would be an amazing Dark Helmet. I think he could cover a lot of the ground that Rick Moranis does, and he'd have a lot of physical humor in there too. So going to go with Rick. Yeah. With Martin Short.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
No, that's a great choice. He's also great in Only Murders in the Building.
Mm-hmm.
And for your Mel Brooks.
Okay, so my dual role of Scroob. Oh, we didn't mention on that Scroob is basically an anagram for Brooks, for Mel Brooks.
Okay, I missed that.
It's not an exact, you know, because it's actually Brooks backwards, but they played around with it. So that's where Scroob comes from.
I didn't know that.
Oh, no?
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I feel bad that I've put it in so late into the show. But anyway, so I thought, who can do this role? And the only guy I could come up with was Larry David. I would love to see Larry David as Yogurt.
For me, Dark Helmet, Dana Carvey. Dana Carvey, I think could really pull it off. I could see
that. Yes, he could.
Because if you dye his hair darker, wear thicker glasses, maybe he could pull it off. But
yeah, I could definitely see him doing the punch drunk scene. That would be pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
And then for Scroob and Yogurt, Danny DeVito.
You sounded like you were talking Swedish there for a second. Scroob and Yogurt?
Scroob and Yogurt.
Yeah. Yeah, all you need is one of those tools to put it together, and then you're...
Sorry. That's right. That's a good choice. Yeah, we did that. Sorry. Danny DeVito. Let's give that some love. Danny DeVito, yes. Oh, my God. Yeah, wearing that helmet? That'd be hilarious. He would look just like a helmet, though. Like, he would have so little body. It would be hilarious.
So Danny would be for Scroob and Yogurt.
Yeah. Right?
But, yeah. Yeah, I think he
would. Oh, sorry. Yes, yes.
But he could also be right. Dark Helmet.
Yeah.
He could be both.
Yeah.
He could do all six roles.
Yeah, that's right. The one man version of Spaceballs. That would be awesome.
I want to see Danny DeVito as Princess Vespa.
Yeah.
That's what I want to see.
Scream in the Park with Danny DeVito.
That's a stunt double.
Spaceballs. Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. Okay. So I picked for the Dreamcast of Dark Helmet. I picked Kevin Spacey.
And
we got Carvey, Spacey, and Short, which sounds like a law firm of comedy. But
so you're going for the acting chops, right? You're going you can do this. You can do that. I got it.
Exactly. But with Scroob and Yogurt, I like Sidney Greenstreet, especially the role that he had in The Maltese Falcon. That kind of character as Scroob or Yogurt would be a very different take, though. It'd be a bit odd.
Yeah, it would be. And yet, I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's toes here, but when we get over to Schrodinger's cast in a minute, it just occurred to me, oh my God, Schwarzenegger would be brilliant as Scroob and Yogurt.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Anyway, so really I hope I have not like stepped on anybody's toes on that one, but alrighty, are we set to move over to our Schrodinger's cast?
Yeah, and this might be a bit odd, so strap in your seatbelts.
And we understand, folks, we understand, listeners, that, yes, we are going to a six-hour format for this show. So just relax, you know, put your feet up. You know, the doors are locked. You're not getting out. Just enjoy the ride.
Schrodinger's Cast. Speed round. Lone Star.
So I have Lone Star, Paul McCartney.
I went with sort of like the of famous bands.
And we didn't know this. We didn't know this prior to this.
No. And it's and so I went with Mick Jagger as Lone Star. And this is the Mick Jagger from the 60s when he's just starting to rock out.
Okay.
First one I'd say would be for Lone Star is Homer. Gotta put Homer because it's just Homer-esque.
Barf is Ringo Starr.
And Meatloaf, I thought, would be the perfect barf.
And then barf would be none other than Barney.
Princess Vespa.
Duh, it's going to be Linda McCartney. Linda McCartney, Paul McCartney. You got the love interest.
I went with Stevie Nicks for Princess Vespa.
So for me, so Princess Vespa, if we're keeping with the Simpsons theme, Jessica Lovejoy. So Reverend Lovejoy's daughter. She only had one appearance in The Simpsons, but man, she was a young, little, dark-haired diva.
Dot Matrix.
And Dot Matrix, of course, is Yoko Ono.
Who would I go with Dot Matrix? And at the moment, I was just thinking of Lady Gaga.
And then Dot Matrix would be Lisa. I think she would be a really good Dot.
Oh, yeah, she would look great.
Dark Helmet.
Okay, so here's my final two picks. My Dark Helmet and my Scroob Yogurt. Which sounds like a flavor. Can I get this Scroob Yogurt, please? Anyway, Dark Helmet. John Lennon. I don't know who John Lennon is.
There's this video by the band Disturbed where they do a cover of Sound of Silence. So the lead singer of Disturbed, his name is, I think it's David Draiman.
So keeping with the Simpsons theme, just for Dark Helmet, Troy McClure.
Oh, great.
A really good helmet.
My name's Troy McClure. You may know me from,
from Spaceballs.
You may know me from such films as Spaceballs.
And Yogurt.
In the role of Scroob and Yogurt, because George Harrison was like the spiritual one, he gets to be Yogurt. So there you go. George Harrison is my Scroob / Yogurt.
And I've got for Scroob and Yogurt, I have Weird Al. Wow.
And then I'm going away from the Simpsons theme only because we had a little bit of a conversation on this. Scroob and Yogurt would be played by Elon Musk.
Oh, excellent. So you want to give the quick skinny on Elon Musk too, Dan, and his connection to Spaceballs for folks?
Sure. I mean, I don't know much about it myself. I know he was on a podcast about 2 years ago, I think. And he was telling the story about how he used to watch Spaceballs a lot as a kid. Maybe his parents left the VHS on the coffee table the same way that mine did. But because he became obviously a multi-billionaire and two things. In his Teslas, he actually has drive systems and modes that are similar, or I think they're identical to light speed, ridiculous speed, and then ludicrous speed. So you can, I think there's different models of like Teslas, but in specific models, you can actually select ludicrous speed as a way for him to show his respect to Spaceballs. So that's number one. Number two is that, like the flamethrower in the merchandising scene, you know, with Yogurt. Yogurt has a flamethrower. You know, he lights it on fire and he says, "It's for the kids," or the kids love it. So the flamethrower that he actually built, which was titled "Not a Flamethrower," he built it specifically from that scene. So he built like 20,000 units of this flamethrower and then sold it. But he only built it and sold it because of the scene in this movie, because Yogurt had one for his kids.
Oh, so, that is awesome.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Yeah, and well, I think we should do a shout out to Wayne's World, because when it comes to merchandising scene, the scene
two.
My brain is melting. Just that whole merchandising scene in Wayne's World is maybe the best of, you know, when he's opening the pizza and he's doing all this stuff and he's just throwing it in the face of people that have actually supported.
Yeah, doing the pale
Pepsi can. When he turns the Pepsi can.
And he goes from one thing to the next, like the Doritos, I think here's one of them, and when there's a pizza and there's something else.
Yeah, so next to Spaceballs, that's the best one. But
Well, and I've got to say too, the hilarious thing is that, you know, Lucas's one stipulation was that Brooks could not do any merchandising for the film, but instead he parodies the whole Star Wars merchandise situation, which is really hilarious. And I will say that I've noticed, I checked online, and you can buy contraband Spaceballs stuff that people have designed, like action figures. So you can have your own little scene like Dark Helmet does playing with figures. Oh, we know that Jewish princesses love men with power, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Knock next like, time. Knock.
Next time, knock.
Yeah. Love that.
Yeah. So, Dan, speaking of merchandising, why don't you tell us what you're up to and what you might have for us available to pick up or whatever? How can we how can we get Red? Where do we find it? How do we do it? What's it all about, dude?
Red is available on Amazon. It's available in 7 different countries. It's also available at Indigo, Chapters, Kohl's, Barnes & Noble's for online purchases. So, yeah, feel free to reach out to Amazon or log into Amazon, search Rhett by Dan Miwa, and it's available there on Prime, and it's available at all the major retailers as well.
And can we get Rhett the flamethrower as well?
Rhett the flamethrower, yeah. That'll come out in the, I think that'll be part of the merchandising effort.
The Kindle edition, yeah.
Kindle edition has just, oh, sorry, go ahead, Dave.
No, please.
The Kindle edition has just launched too, so it launched on April the 27th, and we're currently working on an audio version, and that should be out relatively shortly. That takes a little bit more time for us to get the audio kind of built out and edited. But a lot of work on the way. Also too, like we talked about at the very start of the podcast, working on a screenplay and the graphic novel. We have some really good people that we're working with designing it currently. So that should be out soon. But first and foremost, grab the book. The story is a wonderful, wonderful story. Again, it's something that is it is a story that takes place on another planet. Yes, it's sci-fi in its nature. That is the theme. That is the genre. However, it is very much a coming-of-age story and is very a psychological sci-fi. And the biggest thing that I'm trying to push here is a subgenre, a new subgenre of sci-fi called psychological sci-fi. It's funny. I was doing an interview in Rogers a few months ago, and the producer or the person that was editing like the interview wrote sci-fi wrong. They wrote PSY-FI. And at the time I was like, oh man, are you kidding me? How can you write sci-fi wrong? But then I realized, I'm like, you know what? I'll make a positive out of this. This is actually really, this actually does fit into the whole theme of the story. So yes. And, now we're trying to trailblaze a new subgenre of sci-fi called sci-fi PSY-FI. But all the feedback that we've received from this novel has been tremendous. Really trying to push, you know, the marketing, the promotion, trying to get out there in different venues. So feel free to take a look. The Kindle version does have a sample. It's got about a 3 or 4 chapter sample. So if you're interested, go take a look, take a couple reads, read a couple pages. And if you're interested, purchase a copy and leave me some feedback. It would be terrific. Well,
that's great, Dan. I'm so glad you could make it today because it's been a heck of an episode, and I'm glad we could wrap up this season with you doing this. We didn't quite hit the 6-hour mark, which I was hoping for, but that's okay. I like the fact that this is one of only 2 shows, I believe, that we've done in our illustrious 3+ years where we've had a show that will run longer than the actual film we're talking about. So I'm happy about that actually, because this film needs as much love as it can get. And it was great to have a guest who loves it, you know, more than we do. But we like it quite a lot too now. So thanks for sharing the love.
Thank you for having me, guys. This was awesome.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dan. So that is our Spaceballs episode. And thanks, of course, to Dan for being our guest.
I wanted to mention, as I always do, that, you know, please check us out wherever you can. And obviously you're doing that right now. But, you know, if you could like and subscribe and leave a review if you can, wherever you are. And the great thing is we are absolutely available on Apple now. And I can't tell you how important it is if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts to do the like, subscribe, leave a review or a whatever star rating, please, because that helps to bump us up and it gets us out to more listeners. And it helps to make sure that we want to keep doing this for many more years. Our website is 2numeric2of.ca, and we're always on Facebook, at least until that thing crumbles, because Facebook. Anyway, but we are there, Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi, and we love chatting there. And you know, you're welcome to leave related posts, but related posts, please, and to interact with other listeners and to interact with David and I. And we'll be getting some stuff up related to Spaceballs real soon.
Yeah. And you never know about the future, even though the future is now. Yeah. Elon Musk might take over Facebook. You never know. So
that's right. Because I guess everything, even in the future, is fucked. But oh, yeah. as they say in the film. That's a quote. That's a quote, kids. That's not me. Quoting. Yeah.
Yeah. I am David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next continuing exciting adventure, which could be right now.
Zoom. On
Two Old Farts.
Talk. Sci-fi. I forgot what it's called.